When a lot of people these days are talking about the meaning crisis, and they're talking about how the ration over rational thinking since the Enlightenment has left
Rational.
everything kind of dry and lifeless, that there's this idea of re-enchantment of the world. Well, the world has been enchanted its whole time. It doesn't need re-enchantment. It's our eyes that need to see. We need the re-enchantment. And I feel like both process theology and Jungian psychology both do that.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Free Radical Podcast. Today, I had the pleasure of joining Christian author, theologian, and artist Sherry Kling. Dr. Sherry Kling is a teacher, writer, musician, and guide who helps others move from disconnection and doubt into deeper purpose, passion, and spiritual vitality. She weaves together wisdom from theology, psychology, science, and the arts to spark real transformation. Dr. Sherry Kling is the author of A Process Spirituality, Christian and Transreligious Resources for Transformation, and editor of Renewing Faith, Reigniting Faith and Ministry Through Process and Open and Relational Theologies. As a public speaker, Sherry delivers dynamic presentations to groups and offers courses, concerts, and spiritual retreats. She can be found online at sherrykling.com. We've had a very rich meal today, very rich conversation with Sherry, talking about, as you can imagine, theology, psychology, science, music, faith versus belief, crisis, evil and suffering, and how to understand that in the context of an all-alluring God. So, more than welcome to join us at this abundant feast that with which we have been gifted today. This is the Free Radical Podcast. To support it, please click the bell, subscribe to the channel, and if you feel nourished, inspired by this conversation, feel free to like it, share it, and drop off your comments to keep this conversation ongoing. Without further ado, dear friends, brothers, and sisters, here is Sherry Kling. Welcome, Sherry, to the Free Radical Podcast. Thanks for coming.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. So happy to be here.
It's my pleasure. And the Free Radical Podcast, for me, the meaning of the podcast, the meaning of the name of the podcast has to do with radical, in terms of radix in Latin, like root.
Right.
So going to the root of things and free in terms of to do it in a way that is freeing, liberating, that increases our freedom.
Yeah.
And I always love to ask the guest how it does resound for you, the notion of being a free radical, being an explorer of the depths and roots of things in ways that we get further redemption by doing so.
Oh, I love it. I love the idea of using the word radical for rootedness. And, it's so often used in ways that suggest this fringe element that's so far out there, but really the meaning is such a deepening, and I'm all about depth stuff. So I love that. And just the sense of being able to freely explore without restraints or without only sticking to prescribed notions of things is really important to me, because I always say I'm more interested in the truth. And however it turns out, even if the truth disagrees with my preconceived notions, so.
Well, generally it does, right?
Yeah, exactly.
not only with yours, but universally applicable, yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah, and for me, the notion of also of radical and going to the root implies like going down instead of going sometimes up, as we may think of spirituality, like just upward movement, transcendence, yeah. Otherworldliness, but grounding, descending, right. Rather than transcending only and exploring the roots that with the tree, right? You see the tree, but bigger part of the tree is what you don't see in its roots. So
right.
It's all about going to the invisible and implies a descent work that, as you say, may be unsettling, scary, yes. Terrifying, but
yes,
but
yes,
necessary.
But of course, as you know, as me being a fan of Carl Jung, you know, depth talk is like my my love language, you know. So when we can talk about deepening and you know, in fact, when my own YouTube channel is now called The Sacred Everywhere, I initially started it a few years ago, and I was then calling it Deeper Rhythm. And that came from a quote from Eddie Hillesum, who was a young woman who was killed during the Second World War in the Holocaust, and she talked about listening for the deeper rhythm of life, and so things that are flowing at that. And I think of it both in rhythm, in terms of what we can hear, like musically, but also like a wave, like water, you know, there's just a flow, a deeper flow of life that we can tune into when we're willing to focus our attention downward.
Mm. Thanks for putting all that together. We'll go there in a moment to your love for Carl Jung. You are a songwriter as well. We'll go to rhythm and music. And
okay.
You just mentioned Eddie Hillesum, that it's funny because in a few weeks I'm doing a podcast with an author of a book about Eddie Hillesum.
Oh, really?
Called A Life Transformed. Our main notes diaries are A Life Interrupted.
Yes.
He wrote another one. Patrick Woodhouse is his name from UK.
Oh, wow.
Life Transformed. So glad that she came to visit us in the conversation now.
Yes. Perfect. Perfect.
So we'll try to do that today, to do some radically personal, free radical dive into the roots of reality. And also, I like always to remind myself, actually, and my audience as well, how I came to know about each one of the guests I invite to conversation. In your case, I think, if I'm you correct me if I'm wrong, probably, but it was originally through Jeffrey Long.
Yes,
I think so. We have been friends for a few years, and who wrote actually the foreword to my last book, Evolution in Divine Love, and with whom we share a deep interest in many things, and one of those is with process. Theology, and in that context we did a process pop up a few years ago,
right,
called Hinduism Ever Evolving, and you were the one who presented the talk, introduced the talk, and there we stayed more in touch. You endorsed my last book also, thank you so much for that, and you invited me to your podcast, The Sacred Everywhere. So the minimum I could do is to reciprocate just such generosity to invite you back to the Free Radical podcast. So,
Welcome. Well, thank you. Well, you know, the Process and Faith, which is the program that I direct for the Center for Process Studies, and we host those events, pop-ups, and various things. You know, we, because so much of our original constituency was Christian, and because these were people who had either been students of John Cobb or Marjorie Suhaki and David Ray Griffin at Claremont School of Theology. That was the center of the world around process theology for many, many years. And, you know, these were people who had been their students and then who went on to be leading churches and or their congregants who were then hearing about process theology. And so there was this interest because the Center for Process Studies had typically does more conferences and things that are for academic audiences or involve a lot of academics, even if they're a public audience. And so anyway, the Process and Faith was formed to reach this other audience of people looking to bring process theology into the church. But process theology has always had this dialogue with other traditions. You know, Buddhism.
By definition, process theology will be all about relationality and dialogue and conversation, right?
Right. And so we have relationships with scholars at this level, but at this point in other traditions. And so Jeffrey Long is one of those. And I love his work and have had the opportunity to meet and talk with him. And so, so that was a natural thing to do the event about Hinduism ever evolving, and I know our people, our audience, really really enjoyed that conversation. So and I've certainly enjoyed our conversations each time we've had the chance to talk and be together.
That's what we are here today, and I hope it's not the last one. And so, yeah, I mostly, in one sense, mostly, at least to begin with, discover you from our mutual interest in process theology, sometimes called open, and relational theology in different circles, right. Different ways mm-hmm. to refer to the same. But, and to me personally, and my recent book, Evolution in Divine Love, is very much aligned with many of these topics from the perspective of my Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. But one of the things that interested me the most about it is that, again, it tries to offer a vision of God and of reality as a whole that is not coercive, but relational, as we were saying, more like mm-hmm. a loving presence, inviting the world into deeper beauty, into deeper wholeness, into deeper communion. So I like to ask you, I'd love to hear how you first discovered process theology, coming from a Christian background, but probably not from process theology, Christian background,
right.
And why it felt spiritually compelling to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, my first introduction to it actually came, I've been, you know, curious about all kinds of things for my whole life. And when I was a young adult, I finished college and moved to the Atlanta area and was attending a Lutheran church there. But, you know, I was like reading Bible Archaeology magazine, and I was, you know, investigating, reading the Western mystics, which really resonated with me. So what the mystics have to say about that direct experience of the sacred really, really always resonated with me. And then I got interested in sort of like consciousness studies and energy medicine in the 90s. And I discovered the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Mm-hmm. And I went to one of their conferences and then heard about a book by one of their fellows, Christian De Quincey. And the book was called Radical Nature. And in his point in that book was that consciousness goes all the way down, you know, radical and to the roots and all that, that there's consciousness at every level. And he just pointed to Alfred North Whitehead and process theology. And so I just kind of put a pin in that and thought, I want to learn more about that at some point. And so when I decided to go back to school and pursue a master's and then a doctorate, I first went to the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago for a master's in theological studies. And while I was there at McCormick Seminary, which was next door, Anna Case Winters, who's a theologian, was offering a class in process theology. I was like, oh, okay, now it's my chance to take that class. And meanwhile, since the 90s, I'd been a big fan of Jungians and Carl Jung and Jungian writers. And that started with a book called Women Who Run with the Wolves by Clarissa Pinkola Estes, which was just so powerful for me. And so anyway, in this class with Anna Case Winters, we were reading several texts, of course, one of the main ones being the Introduction to Process Theology by John Cobb and David Ray Griffin. And in their chapter on Christ as creative transformation, I was reading things that to me sounded a lot like Jungian individuation. And that kind of just connected something. And just in general, reading those texts, I thought, wow, this is such a compelling view of God. And it actually resonated more with my own experience. And one experience I had that was super significant for me, again, in the mid-90s, I was traveling in the Southwest and was in Canyon de Chelly, Arizona, and sitting on the rim of the canyon, completely alone, not another person or anything there, looking down hundreds of feet to the canyon floor where the trucks looked like, you know, where the people looked like ants and the trucks looked barely, you know, not that much larger. And I had been done a tour down there and then was sitting on the rim and had this shift in my consciousness where all of a sudden I felt like I was this infinitesimally small speck of dust in the universe, but that I was connected to everything. And I felt that at this kind of cellular level. And of course that didn't last long, that feeling.
That epiphany may have created a momentum that still carries you. No?
Yeah, it does, right. Yeah. So anyway, when I was then reading process theology about this relational world, that there is all this diversity and individual beings, but that we're all interconnected and connected to the whole. So, but then discovering this resonance with what I felt I was reading in the Jungians with this idea of Christ as creative transformation, then that set me on this whole path that led to what I was then, of course, my paper for that class was about resonances between process thought and Jungian thought. And then that developed into my master's thesis. And then I met Philip Clayton, who was then still teaching at Claremont School of Theology, really wanted to work with him, and then took that project with Whitehead and Jung, that focus on those two figures, into my doctoral work and research there.
Thank you for sharing part of your journey.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that beautiful epiphany. Yeah, right. In the midst of nature, no wonder sometimes we have some of our biggest epiphanies.
Yeah.
Alone in nature, but for me, yeah, we are not that alone at all in nature.
right. And, you know, what was funny is then shortly, well, when I got to Chicago, I was taking a flight out of Midway Airport at one point, and I took the bus from where I lived, and I had never gone into that entrance before. And the entrance, this hallway, was lined with photographs from the Hubble telescope. Partly because there was, I think, a movie, an IMAX movie that I then went to see later at the Museum of Science and Industry. But that walking down the hallway and looking at those nebula images.
You were tripping.
I was tripping. I was like, almost started to cry because it was like, it felt like I'm seeing my home, you know, like.
That's dangerous. Many people may have lost their flights just by getting up trapped and tripped into.
Moved into a state of bliss in the hallway of the Midway Airport.
Beautiful, beautiful. I'm thinking, Sherry, of course, regarding in connection to what some of these ideas that fascinate both you and me in terms of process theology and the idea of interconnectedness and relationality, as Father Richard Rohr will say, everything belongs, this idea that everything is contained within this larger whole. Like Ilya Delio will speak about the holarchy in terms of holons, right?
Yeah.
Hole within a hole within a hole.
Right.
And in complement or in perfect harmony with that, also process theology is kind of bringing a reimagination of divine power, so to say, right? As we say, not so much as coercive control, but sometimes I hear the word persuasive love. In my tradition and in many other devotional traditions, as we may call it, bhakti traditions, we also find something quite similar. And that's how I ended up rediscovering my tradition on a new level by the grace of a sister tradition, a sister discipline like process thought. I returned to my tradition. I look at that through those lenses and found so many connections.
Wow.
And we will speak a lot about how the divine attracts rather than forces. In fact, one of the main names for God in our tradition is Krishna, which means irresistibly attractive, basically. Like it's too much, too attractive, like you cannot resist. It's not forcing, but it's too attractive. So, how will you describe this, in your experience, this persuasive dimension of God? And to be honest, I'm still kind of struggling with the word persuasive. For some reason, it sounds to me that there is some type of like manipulation implied between the word lines of the word persuasive. Like if I'm persuading you, trying to, I don't know, maybe it may be a grammatical thing I need to heal inside of me, but I think you get my point. I tend to use more the word like attractive.
Yeah.
Who is very attractive is not trying to manipulate me, but it's so attractive that it's naturally, like if you are again in a beautiful landscape, you wouldn't say the landscape is trying to manipulate me. It's just what it is and I'm drawn to that. How will you describe this persuasive but all attractive dimension of the divine?
Well, and I get that how the word persuasion can almost sound like a malicious public relations campaign, you know, like advertising.
It's loaded. It's historically loaded sometimes.
It's historically loaded, yeah. Let me first say that in process thought, there's this idea Whitehead talks about that all of reality is always in the process of becoming, and that the way reality comes into being is a moment by moment activity and events, not substances that stay the same through time. And so every moment as it arises, you know, kind of it, his metaphysics in a nutshell are that each moment as it's coming into being first arises out of a past world that had already actualized something, and that new moment takes into itself that whole entire past world and everything it did, and that moment has the freedom to decide what it will actualize in the next, what it will become and then give to the next moment. And so it can just repeat its past, like a rock generally just repeats its past. It doesn't have that complex capacity to do new things and actualize real novelty.
So we hear that mountains move in time, yeah, and things like that. Maybe,
right,
again,
right,
by comparison to another speed and all that, but still there, yeah, is some type of becoming going on there.
There is, right. There's always responsiveness to the environment, and you know, but it's much slower. And but in every moment, in fact, what actually kind of calls that moment into being, into its aliveness as a real living moment, and that doesn't just mean living in terms of animal life, it's just sort of when it's a vital moment, that what actually calls it into being is this initial possibility given to it by God, that God in process thought serves as a view of what's possible and has a vision of what's possible, and then gives each moment as it's arising, here's a possible vision for your highest possibility, your highest and best actuality. And then that the moment, you know, it talks about free will and agency, and the moment can actualize that possibility that's given by God, or it can actualize some other possibility that comes again from the past world. And so there is that freedom. And so that initial aim is that momentary possibility that is integrated into the moment and then evaluated. Does this have value for me? Does this have attractiveness? Does this draw me toward it? Me, using the word me, is like that momentary, yeah, you know, which is not the me as the person per se. But and so there's this sense of this, that this, the sacred, the divine, is equally interested in order and novelty, that there's a need for stability, but also that things should be fresh, that life should be zesty and
exciting. Exciting. Oh, I never heard that word. Beautiful. Yesterday, yeah, I was writing about life zest, but I never conceived of it as a verb. Yeah, okay. Every noun should be made a verb because it's moving, right? Thank you.
Right. and so that's where that's the metaphysical basis of this lure, this persuasiveness, this attractiveness. But it's not like a you must do. It's an invitation. Mm-hmm. It's a call, and then each moment responds. So there's that kind of flow of an invitation and then a response, an invitation and then a response. And then whatever the world does in every moment, God takes up into God's self and keeps what is worth keeping, holds what adds to the ultimate harmony, and then pours that back out into the world as invitations in the next moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to think like a GPS, right? Even if the GPS says turn right and we go left, GPS will say recalculating, right?
Yeah.
So that's the responsiveness of God trying to provide with the best possible response to any given moment, to, as you say, the perfect level of harmony for that given moment, and so on and so forth. And you already mentioned that connection, the principle, of course, of free will. And there are so many interconnected topics to, okay, free will, God's existence, and attractiveness, and ideas like omnipotence and suffering and evil. I have some conversation with Thomas Jayord about it.
Yeah.
And I'd like to ask you, because they are also in the process theology world, of course, just to make it clear, it's not that everyone thinks the same way about everything.
Right.
That never happens in any world, just in case.
Right.
So if God works through persuasion or attraction rather than control, inviting in a beautiful, healthy, open way, harmonious way, and we have a choice in the matter, we are not automatons. So how will you, in your own words, what does that mean for how we understand realities like suffering and evil? Again, especially in, not only especially in times like where we are living, because in any time there is suffering and all the things, though generally when what we are going through now seems to be the worst of everything, but if you were living 300 years ago, you will say, oh, this is the worst of everything. So there's always that going on. So what does it mean for how we understand realities like suffering, evil, abuse, trauma, in the context of a God that works through attraction rather than control or imposition?
Right. Well, and you know, this is something that I, you know, feel like I'm grappling with all the time, because you know, there is that, like I said earlier, there's that commitment to the truth and rather than to an ideological system. And so as much as I'm moved by so much in process theology and all of that, you know, there's the Jungian side of me that's talking in this other ear that talks about shadow in God.
I was going to say shadow work, yeah.
Yeah, and in God as well. And and then also I'm really compelled by the, you know, growing number of stories of near-death experiencers who talk about, you know, kind of taking on an assignment in every life. Like, okay, those are the main points. Those are the main milestones of this life that I'm choosing to go into. And yep, it's going to include a certain kind of suffering, or it's going to include a type of family that is going to result in this kind of pain. And not that the whole life is mapped out, but that there's like major milestones, that kind of markers that that each soul agrees to before it comes.
Mm.
And I actually was talking with Tom Ord about that, and I said, you know, what if that's the way it is? And and so that in that scenario, then the suffering is agreed to, not that it's welcomed per se, but that it has a higher goal of growth and development of the soul, which then adds to the growth and development of God. It adds to the whole picture. If we are connected and what we do is taken up by God, then when we learn something or expand our consciousness, that expands in God as well. So he said that, well, as long as it's a choice, you know, he didn't necessarily have a problem with that. So I thought, okay, that's good. That's interesting. Mm. You know, and at the same time, in my own life, I have had experiences that seem to show me that there is a divine hand involved in things that are coming together, whether it be having, you know, being in a situation where I'm like, And you know, and sometimes when we're in a difficulty, like we need a new job, or we are, you know, completely out of a job, or we want to change jobs, or we're struggling and we're trying this and we're trying that. Like I was at a point when I had moved to Florida from Tennessee, I was trying to do my own business kind of a thing, and I was really struggling with that. So I tried it for months and prayed about it, and it just wasn't getting going. And so finally I reached this point where I was like, okay, I obviously just need to get a job. And I had been in the marketing world in the software industry in Atlanta for many years, and I just didn't want to do a corporate thing per se, but I was like, oh, I really just need a job. Please God, lead me, whatever it is, just lead me to an opportunity. And within a matter of a couple of weeks, I had two half-time situations come together that I then took. And so, you know, I know in a process way of thinking, process theologians wouldn't say that that God then, like puzzle pieces, puts it all together. But I also think of more like this sense of a conductor of an orchestra, or maybe like Jay McDaniel talks a lot about jazz and that improvisational. So when if you are a music director and you're working with a jazz band, you might, you know, each one is going to take a time where they're doing what they want. They're playing their solo and you give them free rein, but
still the director perimeter, right? It's not that they do anything and everything.
There is a context. And there's so the director is moving it and maybe just, you know, bringing things, saying, oh, now you come in. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Maybe it's more like that. Maybe it's just that God, and Tom Ward would say, God doesn't single-handedly coerce the world to do anything, but that God works with all the elements of the world. But I do think there is this invitational persuasiveness and, you know.
Yeah, because I'm thinking also God is a person with free will in his own way, being a person, an entity, and having free will, at least from our perspective. So he's participating as the unique individual God is, which doesn't mean he cancels our free will, but which doesn't mean that our free will is the ultimate determining factor in everything. Like in the Bhagavad Gita, which I know you've been a little bit exposed to, we talked about that the other day. Krishna speaks about how in every action we perform, there are many influences at play simultaneously. It's not just me and my free will. So there's God's will, it's me, it's what we will call the karmic momentum, like the result of previous actions that take us to do things in certain ways, some other people's participation. So it's like a multi-layered project of participation, and it's not as simple as it may be, right?
And that was always my problem with the folks that talk about, would say, you create your own reality. I think there is some truth in that. Like often, and I've seen this in my own life, where some way that I've been thinking maybe is limiting my outcome. And if I have a shift in thinking, then there's a shift in the external. But it's not just me that's creating that.
It can be a big weight just to put all the responsibility on your shoulders. It all depends on you and nothing else. And it can be overwhelming.
It is overwhelming.
Carry that level of responsibility. So to know we are, like as you gave the example of the musicians, right? It's not the whole jazz improvisation depends on me, the drummer. No, I had the piano player, the director, the guitar player. We are all, it's a teamwork, right? We are all co-creating.
Right. And there are other forces at work in everything. And it's not just us as individuals. Yeah. So we're part of a moving system of connectedness.
Yeah, and I was thinking regarding what you mentioned a few minutes ago, which I appreciated when I asked you basically a theodicy question on suffering and evil and a God of persuasion and attractiveness, and how you said, okay, sometimes I struggle with that, and that's part of the faith journey rather than rigidly embracing an official dogma that never moves. Like, that's not faith, right? And we will go maybe there in a moment, faith versus belief. But to embrace a genuine faith journey entails struggle, basically, and crisis, and unlearning, and deconstruction, and all that uncomfortable stuff that happens outside in the liminal space. That's how it's real. And in connection to what you mentioned regarding this life and the lessons we go through, of course, in our tradition, we'll speak about karma and rebirth or reincarnation. You spoke about near-death experiences, but somehow it's tied in many cases. In the sense of, maybe one lifetime may not be enough to learn all that we need to learn. and naturally, again, we don't take rebirth as chastisement or cosmic punishment. It's just we need to continue our individuation process, going to Carl Jung, so many layers to integrate. And speaking of psychology, sure, you in a podcast I recently heard, you were talking with Robert Nicastro and Ilia Delio, Hunger for Wholeness. You've been there. I've been there. You've been there. So beautiful.
Yes.
And you already mentioned here your love for Jungian psychology and how that played an important role in your journey toward process theology. So I'm curious, what, if anything, and I'm sure something may be there, what did Jung open up for you that traditional theology perhaps did not?
Yeah. Well, and I started with, you know, it's funny because I think I found that Women Who Run With the Wolves book, I think it came out in the early to mid-90s, and I read it pretty soon after it came out. And so for many years, it wasn't until 2006 that I then actually read Jung himself and started with his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections. Prior, I was reading a lot of Jungians. I was reading, you know, Estes, but also Robert Johnson and Marion Woodman and, you know, I can't even think, but several other people writing from a Jungian perspective. And just in them, what I found was this sense that, especially the way they use myths and fairy tales to talk about the psychological journey. And it just, I saw myself in these stories, and it suddenly opened up to me this possibility that my own life was part of a bigger story, and that I wasn't just experiencing random acts of suffering, but that there was something that my soul was doing and learning and growing through what was happening in my life. And that was just a very hopeful, very meaningful perspective, that, again, that sense of my life has meaning. There is... Mm-hmm.
Creates belonging, right? Creates a sense that I'm part of this bigger thing.
Yeah. I'm part of something bigger. And then when I finally read Jung and read his autobiography, it was... I felt like I had met my soulmate. You know, I felt like, here's my soul brother, you know, because so much of what he talked about just resonated with me. And, you know, just his questioning, you know, he grew up in a church family with clergy in his family, his father, but others as well, I think, and had kind of a, and just saw in his own, what his father was modeling, a very dry, brittle kind of faith. And so he, you know, he was very resistant to it and very questioning about the church, but has had always talked about this, you know, the symbols of the Christian faith having the potential to come alive again in new ways for people, that it's our problem today was that the symbols had died and we were holding on to the old language and the old symbols and not allowing them to come alive for us in a new way. And so that was very meaningful to me as well. And I just loved the way that he talked about the psyche and dreams and synchronicities. And it's just, it's you know, when a lot of people these days are talking about the meaning crisis, and they're talking about the how the over-rational thinking since the Enlightenment has left everything kind of dry and lifeless, that there's this idea of re-enchantment of the world. Well, the world has been enchanted its whole time. It doesn't need re-enchantment. It's our eyes that need to see.
We need re-enchantment, yeah.
We need the re-enchantment. Yeah. And I feel like both process theology and Jungian psychology both do that.
Yeah. They are very enchanting, both of them. Very luring.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that sense with synchronicities that, and with Whitehead too, that the whole cosmos is soaked with value and soaked with aesthetic dimensions that can become numinous for us, like that idea of from Rudolf Otto, of the holy, of having this numinous kind of sparkly energy that, like you said earlier, is so irresistible. It has a magnetic force on us.
Yeah.
And just having that kind of thinking come alive was very powerful for me.
Reminds me of Fyodor Dostoevsky saying, beauty will save the world in terms of aesthetic values and how much meaning and purpose we can find in the content of beauty, and how to conceive a divine and reality as soaked in those values, even in the context, again, without denying suffering and pain, but finding how even in those cases, love and divine presence finds their way to to fill in to the cracks, so to say, right?
Right. You know, I'm just thinking here, Annie Dillard in The Pilgrim at Tinker Creek talks about this tragedy and beauty of, of the world. And the one of the phrases from Whitehead that kind of encapsulates that idea is he's at one somewhere, I think it's probably in Process and Reality, but I'm not sure, says, the fairies dance and Christ is nailed to the cross.
Yeah, and that's the ongoing challenge, right? Because we don't want to lose sight of either of them, right? You don't want just to be like, as I like to call it, harmony junkie. Everything is beautiful and nice and just everything la-la-la land.
Right.
And there's suffering and abuse, but you don't want to zoom in excessively onto the tragedy to the point of losing sight of how much beauty is soaking every moment. So keeping the zooming in and zooming out in proper balance and not losing sight of anything, and learn then to integrate those things, because you could say, no, I'm not losing sight of any of those, but how much are we able to make a whole with double V out of both of them and not create a division or like a fracture in ourselves by putting this, compartmentalizing these two in different boxes, so to say, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and the way Whitehead talks about harmony, it's a harmony with contrast. There's always this contrasting elements or discord even, you know, even in music.
Like music, I was going to say, music.
There are, you know, when we hear a piece of music and there it goes to a discordant sound, it brings a level of tension and intensity.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we want it often. We want it to move to the resolution and give us that release of the tension. But what a such a more richer experience it is when the music includes those elements.
Yeah. In Indian classical music that I'm also a musician, I started learning, playing more drums and guitar, but eventually I learned Indian classical music to some degree. And the melodic patterns, they are called ragas in Sanskrit, which the different compositions will be following a certain scales, we could say, or melodic patterns, that there are certain notes that you are supposed to play an ascending and descending movements, and certain notes that you cannot play because it ruins the mood of that particular pattern. But but certain very good musicians will play those forbidden notes to create that tension, but you have to know when to invoke them, basically, because it's not just, okay, I play any note and I'm invoking different moods. It may be a disaster. But I was thinking about the parallel version of that and how that adds like richness and nuance and makes it even more real. Again, it takes you to a certain experience that, necessitates release, but also you need to go through the tension before the need for the release.
So
that sounds like life.
And it's so hard, you know. I mean, I'm always in this struggle of just like wanting to protest against the messiness of the world, you know, like it just feels
we have so many
like,
good reasons to remain there forever, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's such a hard world. And we have such a hard time with it. You know, it's like in the book of Job, you know, I think we talked about that a little bit the other day, but just that sense of suffering being wrong. And of course, I think we all, even God, mourns over suffering. But I think it's unavoidable in a world that cannot be embodied without the opposites. You have to have opposing energies. I mean, that's the meaning of, actually, of the word Satan in Hebrew is ha-satan, which means the adversary. And it's that sense that in life there's this force that is pressing against and causing it. Without that oppositional force, you wouldn't have boundaries. You wouldn't have differentiation and real things. It's a necessary part of an embodied world.
And And I'm thinking about all that in context of the term that we invoked a few moments ago, which is individuation, which is a very favorite word of mine, probably of you as well, as a process, ongoing process, speaking about process, thought or process life, ongoing process of becoming whole. I was the other day having a podcast with Charlene Kendrick. You may know her. And we were talking about salvation as wholeness making. Right?
Yeah.
Like another word of saying salvation. So individuation as ongoing wholeness making. And in that context, as you also mentioned, there is this other Jungian concept of shadow or shadow work, which is, I couldn't separate shadow work from individuation.
Right.
And in our recent podcast that I was invited to your table, The Sacred Everywhere, you mentioned, and I'm mentioning here because you mentioned that openly, that you have been recently going through some crisis, and I mean, you are not the only one. We are all in the club, so nothing to hide. So to normalize also this type of conversation, hey guys, we have our podcast and we have crisis as well. And bringing Jung and his shadow work along with it. What can you share about how to navigate, at least from your experience, how to navigate our shadow in the context of individuation and wholeness making? Daily practice, basically, as an ongoing issue.
Right, right. Well, I think it's, you know, Jung also talked a lot about projection and that sense, and this is how the psyche has to operate. So projection isn't a bad thing. It's just that we have to own our own projection. So when we're projecting, it's like when I'm seeing out in the world something that stirs up an emotional intense response in me, it means that that is connecting to something within me that needs attention, that needs awareness or needs healing. And so because that is in me, that you know, what I'm responding to is in me, or that there's its opposite is in me. But our psyche is a compensatory process. So it's always the unconscious trying to move us toward wholeness is always giving us opportunities to see what is in our shadow, which really just means what's unknown to us about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, we can have a bright shadow and a dark shadow. If I'm, for example, say I was raised in a family that was very intellectual and not interested in the arts, but I was a really artistic person, maybe I would have repressed that artistic side of myself in order to feel like I could be in this family. At some point in my life, I'm going to need to bring that repressed part of me out into the open and own that that is part of me. And that's a good part of me.
Golden shadow sometimes is called.
It's a golden shadow, right. And just in the same way that I might have perfectionist tendencies or whatever, life is going to give me an opportunity to see that. And so when we're getting an emotional response to something or triggered by something or, you know, finding ourselves confronting, there's that thing again that I always struggle with. It's an invitation. And so I think the way we can practice with that and with doing shadow work is first to recognize when something is trying to get our attention and trying to ask us to consider it and be open to integrating it. So it's just first that awareness, there's something happening here that needs my attention. And then being willing to say, what is it? And for me, you know, in this recent time, this been like kind of revisiting again, this tendency of that we have as humans to want there to be an outcome to our spiritual work, our spiritual healing, our individuating journey. We tend to say, where's the outcome? Where's the life that I'm dreaming of? And it's not like God is the slot machine in the sky or the accountant in the sky that has this ledger. Oh, Sherry has done this much healing now.
Yeah.
Therefore, she deserves X or Y, whatever it is.
As we start to talk about deserving, and on the other side, we always talk about grace and mercy, about justice. So,
exactly. Yeah, but exactly.
Then we get discouraged because we don't get what we deserve. And it's like, okay, I'm a walking contradiction again.
Right. You know, that kind of need for the outcome to be just, to be, and part of it is, you know, again, with my being at this, always being interested in this mythic level of thinking, this mythopoetic, having, where's the meaning, finding, all that is good. But it also sets me up for a need for my outcomes to be commensurate with my suffering. Like if I suffered terribly, then I feel like then I deserve an outcome of this really big love or this really great public career or whatever it is.
And it's not that the outcome or the compensation to the loss, so to say, is not coming, but it may not be just coming in the way we have projected, speaking about projection.
Right. 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 And so, you know, my struggle of the moment is just this sense of seeing the relationship with the sacred. Really, this is works versus grace, you know, in Christian language. This is, do I experience my identity as a child of God because I earned it, because I did enough work and I did enough healing and I individuated hard enough? Or is it because it's a grace that always comes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, healing is a good thing. I've done in my life that has brought healing is a positive thing. Yeah. Healing is a fruit of the Spirit.
Yeah. And in the name of grace, we don't want to be lazy and do not do our homework, so to say.
Right.
But at the end of the day, there is something called grace that we, as I like to say, is too much to be deserved.
Yeah.
The word deserving and earning does not operate on that level. So it's not that we're unworthy of grace. It's just that it's not about trying to earn it. It doesn't operate. It doesn't speak that language. Grace doesn't come that way. It's already coming even when we are in the messiest parts. And Well, you are, if for whatever it's worth. I mean, I don't think you are alone in that crisis at all.
No, I don't think
that's a pretty universal space we all of us inhabit, whether we are aware of that or not. So I'm glad that you are being aware, speaking about the individuation and how to pay attention to what triggers us. Things like this may be framed as a crisis, but maybe basically you paying attention of something that is triggering you, and one sense is a good symptom, as unsettling as that is, right?
Yes, and it's something that is wanting to be healed, that I think the divine is inviting me into it's like I'm thinking of the hermit crab, you know, a hermit crab has a shell that it lives in, but at some point it overgrows that shell, and then it can't, it's like stuffed into a shell that no longer fits it, and it's uncomfortable and it hurts.
Yeah.
And it's invited to step out into the unknown of being vulnerable without a shell until it finds a new one that's big enough,
more
to
spacious,
house it.
That can accommodate more than what we can accommodate now, right? Like an operative system in a computer that runs obsolete, and you need to download the newest app so the system continues to work, and it's an app that allows more functions, but there is a process of shedding the skin, and it feels like dying, literally. It's a death for a new resurrection, like Father Richard Rohr will say, the wisdom pattern of order, disorder and reorder, right?
Right.
So we may be feeling a crisis means disorder, but the disorder is taken to a new order that is more spacious to accommodate what we couldn't accommodate in the previous skin, so to say. Right?
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's difficult for us to admit when we're in these struggles, you know, like, you know, I want to be seen a certain way. I want to be seen as a teacher and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we can forget how often, I think, how much more impactful someone's authentic journey is. And so I try to be honest and to be open, because I think it doesn't serve anybody if I hide the the struggles I experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, am I gonna just, you know, vomit out everything every moment? No. I mean, we also have to be wise and discerning about not being performative in our suffering. Like, oh, look how much I'm suffering.
Yeah. But as you say, because hiding the whole thing in terms even of trying to create an image or religious persona can be another way, subtle way of this game of earning and deserving and being perfect, or at least showing myself perfect. If I cannot be perfect, let me show myself as perfect, therefore I cannot be vulnerable. And it's another side of the same coin, rather than being able to share it again with discernment. And that being shared creates communion, I will say, actually, and gives hope, because other people will see their own journey being mirrored back in the person who's journey sharing their own struggles. We are creating community. We are not alone. It's not your suffering. It's our suffering. Oh, suddenly I find myself in a tribe now, right? It's not.
Yeah.
Because sometimes for me, I like to think, and I fall into that, of course, also, like, we have certain struggle or crisis or whatever, and the real problem is when we isolate ourselves in that experience. Like, I am going through this, and I'm going through this as an individual, but I'm not the only being in the universe going through that. So when I can broaden the horizon and realize it's not my struggle, it's our struggle, I can be held in more spacious space. And because if the isolation unto itself becomes a real problem, if not, I am going through this by myself, and you put yourself into a bubble and the whole thing amplifies itself like 100 more times.
Right. And that idea of being held is so important and so comforting, that in everything we are always held.
Yeah.
You know, we aren't promised to never suffer. We aren't promised a life free of pain and difficulty, but we are promised that we are held in every moment, no matter what's happening.
Yeah. And sometimes we even need literally the physical holding, literal embrace, to experience how we are being held in a more macrocosmic level, so to say, as well, right? So that needs to be there also. Sometimes the best thing we can offer is some physical presence, openness, embrace, not even words.
Yeah.
So, regarding what we were talking before, Sherry, there are many topics to explore, but again, going to this idea of faith beyond belief. And I remember recently you even recommended me a book about it that you've read.
Yeah.
And I will say many people today struggle not so much with spirituality, but with doctrinal certainty, right?
Yeah.
That creates a crisis for themselves, actually, which... So... What does for you, what does faith look like when it is no longer dependent on rigid belief systems?
Yeah.
Because again, for some people, the two are the same, right? Faith,
right.
Religion, spirituality, dogma, belief system, it's all one thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you break a little bit of that, the whole thing collapses. So,
Well, when, you know, when I was introduced to that book in the class on the Bhagavad Gita with Dr. Dasa, and when he talked about it, he talked about what is the stuff of religion and what is the stuff of faith. And like, the stuff of religion is, you know, doctrines, texts, liturgies, prayers, rituals, vestments, hymnals, you know, whatever it is. That's the stuff of religion.
Hmm.
That's the stuff that has a form. But faith is more of a sense of trust in the flow of life. It's a sense of a relationship and of a showing up to trust in that flow of life. And that's formless.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, and I'm thinking here too of, you know, my friend Doug King, who uses spiral dynamics to talk about the biblical narrative. That form has a function, you know. Mm-hmm. Form, it's not that we should eliminate all form. Forms serve a function, but they don't give us our God identity.
Mm-hmm.
our God identity, our sacred interior, is given universally by the source, which is a formless source. Mm-hmm. And those two should be separated, that sense that my identity, who I am, comes from this formless source. I can use form as a practice or as a way to remind myself of that identity, but often in the human world, forms are used as a way to divide. They're used as a way to be in or out, or in my tribe or out of my tribe, or saved or not saved. And in the book Faith Versus Belief, he talks about the word credo is often what is translated as I believe, but really it has more to do with where we commit our heart. Mm-hmm. And where we commit ourselves to something bigger than ourselves. And that sense of faith and commitment is not about that I consent to certain doctrines or beliefs. Those are intellectual, those are conceptual. That's not what faith is. So our beliefs can all come crashing down. And this is what I think is super interesting, because you see a lot of people who go through a deconstruction, they start questioning the doctrines they were raised with or their inherited tradition, and then they think it's all over, I have to just walk away completely. Mm-hmm. And I think they don't realize that in that place of utter destruction, often a new faith can emerge and rise up.
Yeah.
When we're willing to have let it not look like our ideas.
Yeah.
After
deconstruction, reconstruction comes. It's possible. It's not that it's all about deconstructing everything, right?
Right, right. And then often we can then find, in our own tradition, we can find a renewal of the symbols, like Jung talks about. We can find that, oh, now I see those symbols. I see the idea of what a virgin birth might mean, or what a dying and resurrection might actually mean at a deeper level. And now all of a sudden that comes alive for me when I think at that kind of mythopoetic language, the language of mythos versus the language of logos, which is just that rational, you know, it can open it up in a new way.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I was thinking even in part as part of that rediscovery of the tradition or of ideas or beliefs that we may have, and you were referring a minute ago about God being formless or our essence being formless, and I was thinking in our tradition we will speak about that actually God has a form, but uh-huh. It's a spiritual form, which I know uh-huh. is a term that may sound counterintuitive, like, because generally forms are associated with delineation and beginning and end, something limiting. And generally, we acknowledge a formless expression of the divine, but also we acknowledge the possibility of a form that is spiritual or eternal, or a form that facilitates. And I like to think, as you were mentioning, that form doesn't necessarily need to be a dividing tool, like an artist, right? You're, I don't know, a painter. You need a form, a canvas, to express your formless artistic tendency, to make it form, take a form, a shape. You need a form for that to happen, right? So
an
example of form facilitating rather than getting in the way.
Yes.
And I was thinking, when you say about faith and belief, also Jung, once he was asking, you may know this one, like, if he believed in God, and he said, I do not believe in God, I know he exists.
Right, I know.
For me, another beautiful way of speaking about faith versus belief, as we will talk, which is faith is actually experiential, right? It's like something, it's like the trust that comes after an undeniable experience of the numinous, if you will. Like, it's too real to deny, but also it's too vast to comprehend.
So yes.
I can say, I don't know, as I was reading recently, someone, when you have that experience, you can say, I know, but you also can say, but I don't understand.
Right.
I know. Yeah, it's too real. I cannot deny. It's undeniable, but it's so vast. I cannot comprehend. I don't know. So faith implies that perpetual coexistence with mystery.
Yes.
Like, yes, uncertainty, always. It's undeniable, it's real. I had a touch of that, even if it was one point of an infinite line. It was like overwhelmingly more real than anything else I experienced before.
Yeah.
And it still is of such an oceanic dimension that is, I have to have patience with this mystery.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's beautiful.
So sharing connection to patience and mystery and logos, apart from theology, apart from psychology, you quite often bring science into the conversation, like ideas like relational cosmology or quantum entanglement.
Right.
So I don't know, do you see modern science as helping us rediscover ancient mystical intuitions about the interconnected nature of reality? Are you of the idea like mystics said it all, and eventually science is catching up eventually to what mystics said centuries ago, or science can bring new insights that not only complements or confirms but can may even contradict religious revelation, and then religious people are invited to embrace those truths whenever they manifest? I don't know, whatever you may like to hear about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly no scientist. Like Ilya Delio actually had a scientific background, but I did do my emphasis when I was at the Lutheran School in Chicago was religion and science. And so we had these amazing classes where we were looking at, the whole movement from, the Big Bang forward and paleontology and cosmology. And, I always say that when we hear the scientists talking about the biggest scale and the smallest scale, like the cosmologists and the quantum physicists, their language sounds like mystical language more and more.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a beautiful video several years old now. There was there's a musician whose name I'm forgetting, John something, who had this channel, the Symphony of Science, and did these videos where he was taking different comments from different scientists and then putting them together in a song, like auto-tuning so that it was musical. And and there's one called "We Are All Connected," and it has Carl Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson. You've seen it.
I'm taking note of that. I'm not researching it. I'm writing it down.
It's on YouTube. Okay. It's, I think, 11 or 12 or more years old. But it's like in the part that's sort of more like a refrain and has a lot of Neil deGrasse Tyson too. This, like, these lines, like, we are all connected to each other biologically, to the earth chemically, to the, this is talking about different levels, but it's just so fascinating, and it's such a powerful piece of music because it pulls all this together in a way that, to me, ignites that kind of mystical faith. And the
cosmos is filled with musicality, right? There is frequency, vibration. You could say there is song, there is dance.
Right. And I do think that, whether it's whether we're talking about ecology, where nothing in any system, in any ecosystem, can be separated out and said as if it doesn't have an influence on the whole. Everything influences the whole. And when you remove something or try to study something in this reductionistic way, you're never getting the truth.
Yeah.
Yes, it's helpful. Yes, the scientific method and all that was done has produced amazing things. That reductionistic focus has brought knowledge, but it doesn't give the perspective of the whole. And I'm,
like the blind people with the elephant, right?
Yeah.
Touching different parts and concluding this is it, this is that, and you're just getting amputating one partial part and you're not getting the bigger picture.
Right. And I'm thinking too, I can't remember if it was in Yellowstone or Yosemite where they reintroduced the wolves and they found that like an entire area, the landscape radically changed when the wolves came back.
Yeah.
It restored the whole system in terms of what the predators and the prey, and then the bugs, and then the birds, and then the beavers, and the water, like everything was affected.
Yeah.
And it turned what had been kind of a dying landscape back into a lush landscape. I mean, there's video of
it. Yeah, and it's interesting because the ingredient that brought everything back to life was a predator.
It was an apex predator, right?
How much many times in our life these elements that we may see or feel is a predator, is death, is dangerous, is bad, whatever, is what's necessary to bring life back to the whole environment.
right. And so, yeah, so I think there is this kind of convergence happening maybe between mysticism and science. I mean, when people are talking about the quantum field and, you know, all these other aspects, it just, I don't know. I just think this is the language we're going to start using about God and about the sacred and this relationality. It's, it's just showing us that it's like, and I remember Alan Watts used to talk about that the more we study the cosmos, the deeper we go with our knowledge, it's like the further away the cosmos has to grow in order, because like we're the cosmos looking at itself and there's never going to be an end to that process. So he talked about as soon as we think we found the last, most finite, smallest thing, there's going to be another one, because that's the nature of the cosmos looking at itself.
Yeah. And at one point, like you, I know you also love to embrace this interdisciplinary approach of, okay, theology and psychology and music and science. At one point, it's like, okay, I'm going deep into science and I feel like I'm having a mystical experience and I need to express this, okay, in scientific language, but I could use also poetry about it and I could write a song. And at one point, it's all converging into one single integrated reality, ultimately.
Yeah, I did a presentation at a conference we pulled together a couple of years ago with the Center for Christogenesis on Whitehead and Teilhard. And I was talking about the idea that, you know, using Catherine of Genoa saying, "My deepest me is God." She was a nun, and she said, "My deepest me is God." And the same way that Teilhard talked about, the deeper he went into matter, the more he found God there. And then Jung talking about the archetypal self as the God image in the human psyche, and Whitehead talking about God in every moment, initiating that moment into being. It's like it comes through in all of these ways of seeing and talking.
In our tradition, we have a story where an atheistic father is asking his theistic son, where is God? And he's seeing God everywhere. So he's like, where is he not? He's having great trouble in not finding God somewhere.
right. And again, back to the struggle, when we look at the pain in the world and the murders or wars or whatever it is of the day, you know, we it's like, well, where is God there? Well, God is in there experiencing it. You know, like when, you know, I was recently thinking about, you know, in the Lutheran faith, which is the denomination I have been in my whole life, although I certainly, you know, my thinking goes beyond a narrow tradition, there's this importance of the theology of the cross. And I, you know, gosh, I want to kind of turn that around and say, God is crucified in every moment. Every moment as it's perishing, as it's after it's become something and perishes, that's God being crucified in every moment. Every bit of suffering we do to each other, we crucify God and ourselves. And, you know, I think that we're trying to, you know, the cosmos as a whole, God as a whole, is trying to help us learn that this isn't the way.
And that God is everywhere doesn't mean that he's everywhere to the point that we are nowhere, and that cancels our free will and our existence. And because that's not the case and we have free will and existence, there's consequences to our actions, and that's what the suffering we are seeing in the world. But again, that doesn't cancel God's compassionate omnipresence, as I like to say. God is omnipresent, and if you cannot see someone who is omnipresent, that means we are omniabsent. It's not so much that he stopped being somewhere, but it's like we are just looking somewhere else, too distracted, blind, right?
Right.
Sure, we have a few more minutes, so I'd like to share a few thoughts regarding a book you've written.
Sure.
You generously share with me, A Process Spirituality, Christian and Trans-Religious Resources for Transformation. So for the audience, I've received the book yesterday, a day before we are recording, so I didn't have time to go through the whole book.
Right.
But I started and I glimpsed at a few things, and I'd like to begin with a touching important section in the preface where you share quotation from other authors declaring like theology begins in experience and that all theology is autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
Quickly after that, you describe how painful life experience, especially in your personal case, your father's suicide when you were
right.
a child, became like a catalyst for your spiritual search and being, again, a process theologian. I think the word process is not just about things being in process or unfolding, but us processing
right.
those processes.
Right. Right.
So in connection to that, I don't know, I'd like to ask how you've processed your grief throughout the years, which is, I think, is an important topic, how grief work, grief processing, since I think grief work, again, is a crucial complementary thing to all we've been talking about today, and for us to become, again, individuated, wholesome humans, divinely human beings, integrated. So if you have any words about that.
There's been a lot of layers of that processing of grief and sadness and rage and, you know, all the things, all the feels, you know, that we experience. And I think there's, you know, it's first requires a willingness to see our emotions as like rivers that flow by that aren't our identity. And so we, you know, there's a fear always, there's always been a fear in me of if I go all the way in to that abyss, to that deepest, darkest, you know, scariest emotion, there's a fear that I won't come out, that I might...
Too much swimming in again.
Yeah, I might never come out.
Mm.
And, but that's not happened. I have gone in. I have allowed feelings to come up. And partly it's been, especially in the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, I've been really focused on the somatic work, the where is this in the body, in my body, and using different ways of freeing the body. And so whether it's...
Like roll thing, I did do a little bit like that.
What's that?
Roll thing or things like that.
Yeah.
Like really...
Yeah, there's. I had done a little bit of that. That rolfing is very painful, and you know, the way I experienced it was very painful, and I could only take so much of it. But whether it's massage or whether it's yoga or whether it's there's a technique called TRE, trauma release exercises, where you put your body in a posture that then initiates a tremoring response, and when you allow that to move through, then the body starts to release kind of stuck energy. And the idea is that, and I love this so much, because I, you know, I'm preparing to do some teaching for the Hayden Institute coming up very soon, next weekend. And so talking about mind and body and how is, you know, and then I bring in the research from the ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experience study, that showed so clearly that adverse early childhood experiences of trauma have this effect on our later adult health, behavior, chronic disease. Well, how is that possible? We you know, our scientific mindset of today doesn't allow for that. It doesn't even understand how the mind can influence the body. Mm. Of course, we see it done to a very positive degree in the placebo effect, where when we believe something to be true, our imagination makes it true in our body. But Donald Kalshed, who is a Jungian, who has this beautiful book called Trauma and the Soul, talks a lot about when we have an experience, especially as children, that is overwhelmingly traumatic, our body and psyche are too young to metabolize that experience as a whole, meaning the whole experience, the image, the emotion, the physical, the mental, the sound, yeah. the feeling, the body touch, anything that was traumatic for us in a very young child, it's almost impossible to take it all in as a whole. So we dissociate and we split the experience up into parts.
Fragmentation.
And we send the image this place in the body, and we put the emotional affect in this place, and we neurologically or in the brain systems, we just distribute it. But then we don't make sense to ourselves anymore, because now we have no story that holds all this together.
Yeah.
And we then will create an archetypal story, whether that be of the victim or whatever it is that holds it together for us. So what we're called to do later is to retrieve those parts, to allow ourselves to sink. And I think at the body level, it's about sinking deeply in and feeling the body. You know, often I think we walk around this world like brains on sticks. You know, we think we're just... Or like, you know, a head that's just floating around by itself as if us in the brain, that's all we are.
We live in our headquarters.
Yeah, exactly. Literally. But if we can sink down and allow ourselves to notice where is this, like if I'm processing something and I'll start to feel tightness in my throat or tightness in my belly, okay, now I'm going to allow myself to pay attention to that, to sink into that, feel into that. So there's all kinds of ways to process the grief, but I, you know, early on was very much reading and listening to videos and talks by John Bradshaw and his idea of family systems.
The shame that binds us.
Right, the inner child work, all of that. And it's that all was very important, but it wasn't until I really started being committed to being in my body and allowing my body to speak that more shifting really, really happened.
Mm. Yeah, thank you for that emphasis, because many times, and I speak in these cases from my tradition's perspective, though I imagine it's not limited to it, but we live very much, as you say, talking heads or walking heads and headquarters, and we end up living a disembodied spirituality.
Yes.
Right? It's not including all the different dimensions of being, again, speaking about the individuation. And many times the main healing or the main work begins in the immediacy of the flesh.
Yeah.
Rather than head, even emotions, subtle, spiritual, transcendent, otherworldly. Again, going back to the more radical. No? Let's go to the root. Let's do descend work. Let's go down.
Yeah.
Let's go into the body and begin there. Yeah, so much is stored in.
And gosh, when we think about the divine and the world and the relationship there, and in the Christian tradition, this focus on the incarnation.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see that, and many, many theologians don't see that as about just one man, Jesus, being God or being God incarnate.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look at that story, especially in the Gospel of John, and the Word became flesh,
mm-hmm.
the word that's used there, sarx, means like meat.
Okay.
You know, like the God of everything became meat, became flesh.
Yeah.
And so that's where it's at. That's where the divine lives in us, is in our flesh, in our bodies.
Yeah, I remember you say somewhere, maybe it was in a podcast or something related to this, say too, you were speaking about praying into immanence rather than pleading to a distant deity, right? Again, one of the consequences of pushing God too far away and making him only a transcendent being. I'm not saying the divine is not transcendent, but forgetting the immanent side of the equation. Some of the consequences that we end up discarding anything that happens on this side, so to say, of reality. We end up neglecting the world, mistreating the planet. We have the ecological crisis. We have many times in the name of religion and otherworldliness, we end up neglecting our body, living a disembodied spirituality, all by just pushing God too far, like a future tense person.
Yeah.
Giving far away and us being on this side. So praying to immanence.
Right.
I really love that idea.
And in a sense, you know, a lot of people use the term the divine feminine or restoring of the feminine that brings back the honoring of the body and the embodiedness and the incarnational aspect of the divine and how important that is. And that was, you know, I'll tell one more quick little story. When I was living in Marietta, Georgia, I lived there for 25 years, and I was trying then my, you know, career as a musician. I was traveling, but I had fallen in love with this community in Northeast Georgia in the mountains, the Sauti Nacoochee area, and just loved it. And I just really wanted to live there. So I moved there. And when I was looking for a place to live, initially I was having trouble. Like, I had this idea of like wanting to be in this rural landscape, be close to the land. And everything I initially saw was just looked like it might as well have been in Marietta. And I was so frustrated. I'm like, God, please, I just need this experience. And then an ad, you know, was in the newspaper up there about this house for rent. And the ad, it's like, it might as well have said, Sherry, this is your house, you know. And I called and then went to see it. And part of my search was to find my own embodiment, to be closer to a land, you know, kind of a rural thing, and find the divine feminine. And so I went to this house, and it was this amazing little 100-year-old farmhouse on 8 acres of land, and hardwood floors and beadboard paneling, and it just this like this beautiful little cottage. And when I walked out to the barn up the hill at the back of the property there, leaning against the barn like it was yesterday's trash, was a statue of Mary, Mother Mary. Mm. And I just thought, well,
here it is. There she is. Divine feminine, welcome home.
She's calling me here.
Beautiful. I recently, someone sent me a message that sent something, because in our tradition also we have this idea of the divine feminine, the divine masculine, the two of them, like two polarities, like a yin and yang, and the two of them have to be balanced with each other. Yeah, right. Someone wrote something like, if we only worship the divine masculine, we're halfway to atheism.
Ooh, God,
I like
the
way of
phrase.
Putting it, right? If it's only, if I only get the half of the equation of the divine, that's halfway toward atheism.
Wow. And, you know, Jung talks about that the talk of the ascension of Mary, that was this need to place the feminine in the Trinity alongside and make it a quaternity of adding the feminine. Now, I personally see the Spirit as feminine.
That's what I was going to say. Many Christians will see the Holy Ghost or the Spirit as embodying the divine feminine historically.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Sherry, I don't want to take more of your time. We could continue for forever. And as I like to think, we always have forever on our sides, eternity is on our side, supporting us to continue doing that in eternity. But before putting our sharing to rest, I don't know if there is any final words, conclusion, inspiration you would like to share with us, with the audience today.
Just, I would say to stay open to the promptings and invitations through synchronicities and dreams and whatever arises in your life, in the flow of your life, that's where God, the Spirit, the Divine is wanting to speak.
Amen to that.
Amen.
Thank you so much for joining us in the For Radical podcast.
Thank you.